Please note that this podcast will contain spoilers for volumes 1 and 2 of the Talon comic series, specifically all of the issues from issue number 2 to issue number 14, Batman and Robin issue number 23.2, the first 8 episodes of the Gotham Knights television series, and Christopher Nolan's 2008 film, The Dark Knight. I am a nightmare that will stalk this city forever. There is no killing me. These were the last words of Felix Harmon, notoriously known as the Gotham Butcher, before he was killed for the second time by a woman whose family he had tormented, named Casey Washington. Harmon was cut off and killed before he could finish speaking the word, me. Harmon spoke these words in his final comic appearance to date in Talon issue number 14, which was written by James Tynan IV. Harmon's prophetic warnings that he could never truly die due to the nightmarish mass psychological effect that he will have on the denizens of Gotham City certainly is apt, considering the massive trail of blood he left in his wake. Harmon was introduced as a very insidious and diabolical character within the Talon comic series in Talon issue number 2, which features writing and plotting credits for both Tynan and Scott Snyder. In this very first comic issue, he is described as the Gotham Butcher, having killed well over 100 civilians in his reign of terror throughout Gotham City. It should be noted that the level of violence inflicted by Harmon throughout his appearances is deeply disturbing. Since the violence is fictive, it can sometimes feel gratuitous. It really is horrifying, the sheer callousness through which violence is portioned out by Harmon in his appearances. One has to wonder why Harmon was written to be so excessively violent in the first place. I was taken aback by the excesses of Harmon's violence and find it deeply unsettling. I believe that this is probably the intention of Harmon's character, not to glorify violence, but rather to analyze the cult of violence, particularly in regards to how it is endorsed by the elites of society. Harmon is never written to be a sympathetic character, necessarily. He is a pure evil character within all of his comic appearances, and is a remorseless serial killer. In Connor Mannion's Medium article titled, Are People Missing the Point of American Psycho?, it is explained how Bret Easton Ellis' book, American Psycho, arguably glorifies the violent actions of its protagonist. Quote, the best way to think about book Patrick Bateman is to think about how we are invited to think about Arthur Fleck in Joker. He's not a bad person. The world just stepped on him one too many times, and now he's alienated and has no recourse but to lash out. End quote. In contrast, there is something to be said for a character like Harmon, who has no sympathetic reason or backstory for why he became a violent person. This type of person is not intended to be sympathized with, and their violence should especially not be glorified. Unlike a character like Arthur Fleck in Joker, there is no mental health illness that can be used as a scapegoat for Harmon's actions, and thus, people with mental health illnesses are not antagonized through his appearances. Harmon simply is an evil, despicable, atrocious human being. As audience members, we can analyze what he represents and means for society at large, but we are never meant to empathize with him. Harmon left a bloody and twisted legacy on Gotham City that scarred it long before many of Batman's other villains were born. Harmon certainly belongs within the Batman Rogues Gallery because not only did he come to blows with Batman throughout the Talon comic series, but when Harmon was adapted for the Gotham Knights television series, it was revealed in episode 4, fittingly titled Of Butchers and Betrayals, that Harmon was responsible for killing Batman in this show. This makes Harmon one of only a select few villains to have actually killed Batman, thus justifying his inclusion within Batman's Rogues Gallery. However, while the emphasis on Harmon is often simply on his insatiable and disturbing bloodlust, I believe that there are a number of concepts and ideas conveyed through this character that make him an intriguing source of study. I am Paxton Phillips, and this is WCCS Radio. Harmon's rampage throughout Gotham City and the reactions to it inform readers about the concept of organized chaos and how it suits the elites of society, represented in DC Comics, of course, by the Court of Owls. The Court of Owls is an ancient secret society, comprised of Gotham's most privileged and elite citizens, that seek to control the city in whatever ways they deem appropriate. The Court of Owls employs assassins known as the Talons to murder anyone that dares to challenge their power. Harmon was first initially employed as a Talon for the Court of Owls. In Batman and Robin, issue 23.2, titled Court of Owls in Exquisite Dread, written by Tynan, a member of the Court of Owls recounts the story of Harmon to his daughter, prefacing it with a discussion of, quote, fear of what we can't control, end quote. This issue reveals that in 1862, in the Narrows, a historically impoverished area of Gotham City, a member of the Court of Owls found Harmon indulging in his bloodlust by murdering dozens of civilians. This Court of Owls member, referencing how newspapers had begun to refer to Harmon as the Gotham Butcher, balks at Harmon's rampage, telling him, quote, the papers shouldn't be calling you anything. You are our Talon. You do not kill unless we tell you to kill, end quote. Harmon responds to this member of the Court of Owls by asserting that, quote, you promised me blood, and you have not provided. This city belongs to the Owls. This prey is fair game, end quote. The member of the Court of Owls stammers that, quote, you will alert the world to our presence, end quote. Showing little concern, Harmon promptly states that, quote, this is all rather tedious. Perhaps it's time I change the game, end quote. With that declaration, Harmon murdered the member of the Court of Owls standing before him. In Talon issue number 2, a member of the Court of Owls describes Harmon, saying, quote, that monster killed 140 untargeted civilians and two members of the court during his time as our Talon, end quote. In response, another member of the Court of Owls says, quote, he did it out of boredom. The court of that era didn't give him a challenge befitting of his strength or power, so he challenged himself. End quote. In this discussion amongst members of the Court of Owls about Harmon, it is revealed that the Court of Owls trapped, killed, and entombed Harmon in the Tomb of the Unworthy deep beneath Gotham City in the 1860s. In Batman and Robin issue number 23.2, a member of the Court of Owls attributes the perceived imperative for Harmon's death as a result of Harmon's brutal reign of terror, catching the attention of the national press and forcing the Court of Owls to retreat into the shadows for a subsequent decade. The words that the Court of Owls used to describe Harmon and his victims reveal just as much about them as they do about Harmon, framing Harmon's victims as, quote, 140 untargeted civilians is particularly disturbing. Because it implies that if these civilians had, in fact, been targeted by the Court of Owls, then they would have tolerated Harmon's murderous rampages. The member of the Court of Owls that confronted and was killed by Harmon in 1862, on the pages of Batman and Robin issue number 23.2, even emphasizes that Harmon should not kill unless he is told to kill by the Court of Owls. This all is revealing of the fact that the Court of Owls did not necessarily murder Harmon because he was a nefarious serial killer, but rather because he was killing civilians that the Court of Owls did not specifically instruct him to murder. The Court of Owls certainly tolerates murder. However, it has to be murder that the Court of Owls itself preordains. The Court of Owls is sanctimonious about condemning the violent actions of Harmon, despite it committing similar atrocities. The delineation is that Harmon's murders were not supported by the institutions of Gotham City, whereas the murders conducted by the Court of Owls were. The Court of Owls tolerates chaos, however, only if it is organized chaos. Chaos that they can control. Despite how absurd it may seem for the Court of Owls to decry Harmon's actions as inhumane, with one of the members of the Court of Owls even exclaiming, in Talon issue number 2, quote, the Gotham Butcher? God, end quote, as if to suggest some sanctimonious contempt for Harmon's murderous actions, while simultaneously ordering the murders of dozens of individuals themselves, the importance of organized chaos for the elites of society is actually rather prescient and realistic. In the 2008 film, The Dark Knight, directed by Christopher Nolan, the Joker, played by Heath Ledger, tells Two-Face, played by Aaron Eckhart, that, quote, "I just did what I do best. I took your little plan and I turned it on itself. Look what I did to the city with a few drums of gas and a couple of bullets, hmm? You know what? You know what I noticed? Nobody panics when things go according to plan. Even if the plan is horrifying. If tomorrow I tell the press that, like, a gangbanger will get shot or a truckload of soldiers will be blowing up, nobody panics, because it's all part of the plan. But when I say that one little old mayor will die, well, then everyone loses their minds. Introduce a little anarchy, upset the established order, and everything becomes chaos. I'm an agent of chaos." End quote. Joker's speech to Two-Face describes exactly why the Court of Owls despised harm in becoming the Gotham Butcher. The Court of Owls very much represents the established order that the Joker described, and the people that were murdered in the name of the Court of Owls were all done so according to the plans enacted by the Court of Owls. The Court of Owls are the bastions of organized chaos, while Harmon, much like the Joker, was an agent of chaos who introduced anarchy into Gotham City that upset the established order. Similarly, despite its proclamations to fight terrorism and its reputation as a humanitarian safeguard, the United States government has historically fostered a sprawling terroristic apparatus that has directly incurred significant civilian casualties. As Quint Hoekstra details in the Taylor and Francis Online article titled "Helping the Contras, the Effectiveness of U.S. Support for Foreign Rebels During the Nicaraguan Contra War, 1979-1990, the United States government provided extensive support for a terrorist group seeking to overthrow the Sandinista National Liberation Front government of Nicaragua between 1979 and 1990, this group being the Contras. United States President Ronald Reagan drastically increased the support afforded to the Contras by the United States, and the Contras weaponized the power afforded to them from Reagan and his subordinates and used it oppressively by engaging in acts of terror. As Holly Sklar describes in the book titled Washington's War on Nicaragua, in the Red Christmas Offensive, the Contras killed, tortured, and mutilated 60 or more individuals, including civilians. The Contras ransacked a hospital and raped a doctor and nurse working there for being tangentially associated with the Sandinista government, boasting of their support from the United States. Reagan and his administration were funding and empowering terrorists in Nicaragua for many years. However, because the chaos that Reagan was inciting was his own organized chaos that furthered his anti-communist agenda, Reagan not only tolerated the terrorist actions of the Contras, but rather ensured their continuation. In Robert G. Douglas's paper titled Being Successfully Nasty, the United States, Cuba, and State-Sponsored Terrorism, 1959-1976, it is explained how, in 1986, the International Court of Justice found that the United States was guilty of violating international law, in that it targeted civilians and its state sponsorship of the Contras, and ordered the United States to pay reparations. The United States ignored the ruling. The Iran-Contra scandal was hardly the only time in which the United States government sponsored terrorist organizations throughout the world out of a fear of communism. According to Douglas, political analyst Noam Chomsky credited the United States with conducting a, quote, campaign of international terrorism, end quote, against Cuba, spanning from the United States President Dwight D. Eisenhower's administration to United States President Richard Nixon's administration. Economist Edward Herman also categorized the United States as, quote, the manager and sponsor, end quote, of a, quote, terroristic assault on Cuba, end quote. As is explained in the Bay of Pigs 40 years after chronology, small bombing missions and aerial destruction of sugarcane undertaken by Cuban insurgents supervised by the CIA began in 1960. On January 21st, 1960, four bombs targeted an urban center, and a week later, houses in the central Toledo in Havana were targeted. On February 18th, 1960, a plane conducting an aerial bombing exploded, and the pilot was found to be an American with a United States military identification card, leaving little question as to the United States' involvement in violent acts that targeted civilian areas and created widespread fear among the Cuban populace. Ultimately, the sponsorships that the United States provided for the Contras and the Cuban insurgents, specifically Brigade 2506, both reveal several noteworthy trends. Both sponsorships were forged as overreactions to Central American governments adopting differing political ideologies from that of the United States. The fear that the United States had of communism throughout the Cold War incentivized it to sponsor terrorist organizations out of a desire to implement regime change in sovereign countries. It seems that the United States felt that its status as a hegemony was threatened by the emergence of governments in close geographical proximity to itself with socialist leanings. The United States, in both of these examples of state sponsorship of terrorism, do seem to be motivated by the ends justify the means mentality of utilitarianism. In his article titled Cuba in the Crosshairs, A Near Half Century of Terror, Chomsky describes the utilitarian mindset of United States President John F. Kennedy, who enacted the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba in an effort to depose its leader, Fidel Castro, from power, employing terrorist groups such as Brigade 2506 to do so. According to Chomsky, when discussing the threat of Russian missiles in Cuba, Kennedy revealed a disturbing belief system that, quote, the Bay of Pigs was really right, end quote. Kennedy perceived supporting terrorists that murdered innocent civilians as being justified if it played any role in reducing perceived threats from Cuba. The ultimate strategic failures of the United States sponsorship of the Contras and Brigade 2506 were major embarrassments to Reagan and Kennedy. They were also significant moral blemishes on the tenures of both presidents. Reagan spoke fondly of the United States being a shining city on a hill. Kennedy spoke fondly of paying any price to support the survival and the success of liberty. These grand moral gestures, however, were severely undermined by the unethical practices of supporting terrorism. Much like the Court of Owls, many of the leaders of the United States government have performed displays of sanctimony when addressing acts of terror while simultaneously enabling it themselves. The United States government, much like the Court of Owls, relies on the concept of organized chaos, instilling chaos in countries that it can control and manipulate to its own ends. In Paul Vallely's article in the New York Times titled A Church for the Poor, it is explained how Reagan decried Reverend Miguel Descoto Brockman, who served as foreign minister in Nicaragua's Sandinista government after the Sandinistas overthrew the Somoza dictatorship that had been backed by the United States, as an, quote, international outlaw, end quote, and, tellingly enough, a, quote, butcher, end quote. However, who are the real butchers? Reagan called Brockman a butcher while simultaneously facilitating terrorist attacks in Brockman's own country, attacks that killed dozens of innocent civilians. In the case of the Court of Owls, Harmon may have been a butcher, but so was the Court of Owls. Just because their chaos was organized does not make it any less chaotic and violent. Just because it was part of the plan of the established order does not make it any less barbaric and bloody. When the elites refer to individuals as butchers, that often serves as a scapegoat for their own butcher-like actions. Reagan's vice president, George H.W. Bush, even brazenly proclaimed that, quote, I'll never apologize to the United States of America, ever. I don't care what the facts are, end quote. In 1988, after the United States shot down Iran Air 655, an Iranian passenger airplane, killing all of the 290 civilians on board, as is documented in a tweet from historian Stephen Wertheim from June 21st, 2019. When the United States commits and sponsors acts of terror, or kills innocent civilians, the entirety of the American public does not often panic, because it is part of the United States government's plans. However, when acts of terror are committed against the United States, there tends to be significantly more public outcry. Interestingly, Bush was a member of what probably might be the closest equivalent to the Court of Owls in real life, the Skull and Bone Society. As a Yale college student, Bush joined the hyper-secretive Skull and Bone Society, making connections that he used to advance his career throughout the rest of his life, including during his early start in his oil business, as is recounted by Russ Baker in the Salon article titled, Elite Secret Society Tied Bush to Circles of Power. Much like the Court of Owls, who, in episode 7 of Gotham Knights titled, Bad to Be Good, extorted noted criminologist Detective Sophia Green into stealing paintings that once belonged to deceased architect Alan Wayne, the Skull and Bone Society have reportedly engaged in numerous large-scale heists over the years, seemingly being affiliated to or connected with the Bush family. As is explained by James C. McKinley Jr. in the New York Times article titled Geronimo's Heirs Sue Secret Yale Society Over His Skull, Bush's father, Prescott S. Bush, who was also a member of the Skull and Bone Society, allegedly broke into the grave of Apache warrior Geronimo with some of his classmates and stole Geronimo's skull, two bones, a bridle, and some stirrups. These were all apparently put on display in the Skull and Bone Society clubhouse known as the Tomb. It should be noted that, while widely reported, this story about the theft of Geronimo's skull and these other items are rumors and should be treated as such and not as definitive fact. As the New York Times article titled, Yale Journal, Women in the Crypt, Old Bonesmen Say No, recounts, the skull of former United States President Martin Van Buren is also rumored to be housed within the Skull and Bones tomb. While the theft and pillage of these items by the Skull and Bone Society may be rumor, the power that they have as a group is fact. Former Republican United States President George W. Bush, the son of George H.W. Bush, and the grandson of Prescott S. Bush, was also a member of the Skull and Bone Society, and, according to Suzanne Goldenberg in the Guardian article titled Skeletons in the Closet, quote, the president has surrounded himself with bonesmen for most of his life. He used bonesmen connections to get his first real job, finance his first oil company, and his ownership of the Texas Rangers baseball team. Bonesmen have also contributed to Bush's campaigns, even sworn Democrats, end quote. Goldenberg quotes Alexandra Robbins, the author of Secrets of the Tomb, in the article, writing, quote, Bush's use of Skull and Bones is an example of how this kind of secret society can propel a model of mediocrity through society, Robbins says. And once he attained office, he rewarded members of Skull and Bones with prestigious positions in his administration, end quote. Bush's connections to the Skull and Bone Society, contrary to his public image as an ordinary American, led him to run one of the most elite presidential administrations, with, according to Goldenberg, quote, within the first year of Bush's presidency, all but one of the other 14 bonesmen from the class of 1968 had spent a night at the White House. Etra was appointed to a commission on the Holocaust. Another friend, Roy Astin, was rewarded with an ambassadorship to Trinidad. A third, Robert McCallum, became an assistant attorney general. In all, Bush has promoted at least 10 former bonesmen of different vintages to key government posts, including the head of the Security and Exchange Commission, Bill Donaldson, 1953, and the general counsel to the Office of Homeland Security, Edward McNally, 1979. End quote. Similar to the Court of Owls, the Skull and Bone Society have been rumored to have been secretly controlling the government for generations. In the 2004 presidential election, both incumbent President Bush and his Democratic rival Senator John Kerry had to be members of the Skull and Bone Society, lending credence, as Goldenberg notes, to conspiracy theories that, quote, have long insisted that the world is controlled by a shadowy network of Yale alumni, and the Kerry-Bush contest feeds directly into that fantasy. End quote. As Abby Jackson and Christina Sturbenz explain in the Business Insider article titled, The 13 Most Powerful Members of Skull and Bones, the Bush family did not consist of the only presidents to have been part of the Skull and Bone Society, as United States President William Howard Taft was also admitted as a member, likely as a result of his father, Alfonso Taft, co-founding the Skull and Bone Society as a Yale student in 1832. The fact that so many leaders of the United States have been members of the Skull and Bone Society, and that, as of 2004, according to Goldenberg, there were believed to be fewer than 800 living members, certainly makes it apparent that this elite exclusive secret society, similarly to the Court of Owls, has, in fact, been influencing politics for generations, dating all the way back to the 1800s. The Court of Owls felt threatened by any potential changes to the status quo in Of Butchers and Betrayals, Batman's personal attaché in his civilian persona of Bruce Wayne, Cresta Clark, tells Batman's son, Turner Hayes, that she slipped a toxin into Batman's food to dull his reflexes and make it possible for Harmon to successfully murder him. In Gotham Knights Episode 8, titled Belly of the Beast, Clark tells Hayes that Wayne, one of the wealthiest men in Gotham City, was killed for changing his will, explaining that, quote, your father was going to give his fortune to the people of Gotham. The city's poor would no longer have to resort to crime to survive. Crime thrives on poverty. The court thrives on crime. Bruce wanted to break that cycle. The court couldn't have that, end quote. Both the Court of Owls and the United States government felt that the status quo that kept them in power was threatened by the potential redistribution of wealth. In the CBR article titled, The Bat Signal, Tynan Brings Bane to Talon, Tynan is even documented as saying, quote, one of the biggest strengths of the Court of Owls is the system. They use the status quo, and they use Gotham City or the government to wield their power. They need the system to stand in place for them to rule. End quote. Much like the Court of Owls tasking Harmon with murdering Batman to maintain the status quo in Gotham City, thereby keeping them in power, the United States felt threatened by the changes in the status quo taking place in countries in Latin America, such as Cuba and Nicaragua. These new socialist-leaning governments that rose to power in those countries made leaders and presidents of the United States deeply concerned about the spread of communism during the Cold War. The Court of Owls and the United States government rely on the status quo in order to maintain hegemony. In Batman and Robin issue 23.2, one of the primary featured members of the Court of Owls prefaces his description of Harmon to his daughter by a discussion about, quote, fear of what we can't control, end quote. This is the key rationale behind the actions of the Court of Owls, and can even be applied to the United States government as well. The redistribution of wealth incurred by Wayne changing his will, and the fear of communism taking hold in Central American countries, ultimately stems from a fear of what the elites will not be able to control once such changes are made. Harmon represents this fear of what the elites cannot control, and that is why he was ultimately killed for it by the Court of Owls. This fear of losing control to Harmon was on full display in Bad to Be Good when Hayes attempts to exchange a painting owned by Alan Wayne for Green's captured family with the Court of Owls. Hayes gives the Court of Owls the painting, and the Court of Owls attempt to go back on their word to return Green's family in exchange, preparing instead to betray and murder Hayes. However, Hayes reveals that he has Harmon's daughter, Eunice Monroe, held hostage as well, and warns the Court of Owls that they better exchange Green's family for Monroe, lest they incur the wrath of Harmon. Tellingly, the Court of Owls agrees to this deal and returns Green's family in exchange for the safe return of Monroe to the Court of Owls. Had Hayes been holding someone other than Monroe hostage, the Court of Owls may not have agreed to this deal. However, the fact that the Court of Owls was afraid of what would happen if Harmon got agitated, if something harmful were to happen to his daughter, does underscore how truly fearful the Court of Owls was of losing control over Harmon. The lack of any compelling motivation behind why Harmon became the Gotham Butcher is on display in a conversation he has with Sebastian Clark, the former Grand Master of the Court of Owls, in Talon, issue number 12. In this comic issue, Clark asks Harmon, quote, "You aren't even a man, are you? You're simply a force of nature, death incarnate," end quote. Harmon, smiling at Clark, tellingly responds with, quote, "Yes," end quote. Harmon was perfectly happy with Clark denying him his humanity because he clearly did not feel like he had any. The mistake that some analyses make with serial killers, as well as some depictions of them in media, is providing them with far too much humanity in an effort to earn sympathy for them from the audience. Harmon's character evades this trap by being a more well-written character for his lack of humanity, not in spite of it. In this same conversation, Harmon and Clark, both vengeful towards the Court of Owls for repeated perceived transgressions, collaborate on a plan to destroy the Court of Owls. In vocalizing his belief for the best way to destroy the Court of Owls, Clark declares, quote, "Let's kill Gotham City," end quote. The wording is particularly important because Clark seems to believe that Gotham City needs to be killed as if it were a living entity and not simply destroyed or demolished. This plan also underscores how the Court of Owls draws its power from Gotham City. The Court of Owls needs the institutions of Gotham City to stay in power. Without Gotham City, the Court of Owls would have no purpose. This plan concocted by Clark ultimately fails. However, it does highlight how anarchy is the true enemy of the Court of Owls, while the status quo and social stratification are its strengths. A very intriguing choice that Gotham Knights made in adapting Harmon to screen was to render the character completely voiceless. In all the episodes that Harmon appears in, he does not speak a single word. Harmon literally has no voice of his own. The only way he is able to seemingly communicate words to people is through his violence. Much like in Talon issue number 12, in which Harmon scrawls the words, quote, "You're next," end quote, in blood, with his message being found by his enemies, Calvin Rose and Batman. In episode 1 of Gotham Knights, titled Pilot, the words, quote, "Your bat is dead," end quote, are scrawled in blood after Harmon kills Batman in Wayne Tower. Harmon does not need to speak a single word in Gotham Knights, because violence has its own voice. The United States, Harmon, and the Court of Owls speak loudly through their violent actions, without saying a word. I am Paxton Phillips, and this is WCCS Radio.